am convening this meeting of the House Interim Committee on Revenue. Today is Tuesday, September 25th. Welcome, everybody. I want to begin by thanking Representative Barnhart for his leadership for many years and in preparing an agenda and setting things up so that I was coming into a situation where we have a great working relationship with committee members and the staff. So first is the thank you to Representative Barnhart, and second is a thank you to all of you. I'm really pleased to be joining this committee, and I think we're all going to enjoy it. I know we're only an interim committee, but we have important things that we talk about. I'm really looking forward to being with you. Also, for those of you in the audience, my aim is to not necessarily spend an entire 3 hours, even though 3 hours was carved out in our schedules. We're hoping to finish a little more quickly than that today.
It's a wonderful start, Nancy.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy committee members is a good objective also. I'm opening this informational meeting. We have four agenda items for this informational meeting. Mr. Alanek, will you please present the items?
Sure. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So the four items, just kind of going through in order, the first one is by Business Oregon, and it's a discussion of the nuts and bolts of opportunity zones. This is a policy that the state tied to. It's a federal policy. It was part of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act enacted last December. Oregon is tied to that policy, so this is an opportunity for the committee to hear basically just the nuts and bolts of the program. And then after that, the committee will hear from the Department of Revenue related to administration issues, again, tied to the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. That's largely going to be the theme of the day in terms of the impact of that federal law on the state. And then we'll move to the two federal the state tax credit auctions that we've had. The committee will get an update on how those auctions went and what that might mean for the future. And then rounding out the day will be LRO staff talking about our income tax connection to federal law. And this is kind of it's the third piece of a discussion that's been going on since May. We had part one in May, part two in August, and this is the third piece of this discussion. It's really touching base again, all of the implications of how we're connected to federal law.
Thank you. So first up is Business Oregon. Oh, Representative Smith, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being late, but I'd be remiss if I didn't say how wonderful it is to have you Chair of Revenue. I've had a chance to work with you, as you know, in Ways and Means for many years. And Representative Barnhart did a fabulous job, and I know you're going to do equally as well. And so it's wonderful to have you as chair.
Oh, thank you. And we sat next to each other for
That's
all
right.
those years.
That's right.
Business Oregon.
Chair Nathanson, members of the House Interim Revenue Committee. My name is Arthur Fish with Business Oregon, the Oregon Business Development Department, and it's a pleasure to be here. And, you know, I'm learning a lot about federal opportunity zones as we go along here, so maybe we can have sort of a joint primer about some of these nuts and bolts that staff refers to so eloquently. Just to go back to the beginning, there has been some legislation in Congress going back a few years, fairly widely supported ideas about this. A good chunk of that made it into the tax reform legislation that Congress enacted at the very end of last year. It wasn't a huge piece of the legislation, you know, publicly as far as so. I did not learn about it. I don't think people in Oregon generally learned about it until about a month later. And that left us with 3 months to help the governor decide which of the some, 300 low-income communities, places with quite remarkably high poverty rates and, low-income levels that could be selected. About 25% of them could be, and there are today, with the nominations that were approved by the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, pursuant to our submission by April 20th, of 86 census tracts. The whole census tract, just what it is, and these are areas that do have a great deal of economic issues with them, as indicated statistically at least, and I think on the ground too, as I know very well. And those 86 opportunity zones are the places that can receive investments. Okay, they can receive investments that are, shall we say, tax incentivized or tax induced through the federal tax code. And we can get a little more into how that might connect with Oregon state taxpayers state income taxpayers. And I would bring you first, and I should just point out, as far as Business Oregon's role, I mean, we're at this point, we were very engaged with the governor's office and helping to identify areas and look at their needs and relative potential to use this tool, because we can only select so many, and obviously it involves some hard choices at the cusp. But what these zones do definitely goes a little beyond our more traded sector manufacturing type of orientation with the majority of programs at Business Oregon. It can involve a variety of community development, economic sectors, and that sort of thing at where these opportunity zones exist. And at this point, we don't have a particularly official role with these zones. We're trying to look at what capacity we have and the resources and how we can partner with a variety of entities out there to help to promote or make the best of these opportunity zones, the opportunity of opportunity zones, if you will. And so that's kind of the gist of it, just to give you some reflection. It's not even really a program under federal statute. Because of the way it was done with tax reform and the legislation had to be limited to basically revenue-relevant provisions, it's basically just part of the tax code. I mean, the IRS is writing rules for this, which are very critical at this time, and most things are kind of waiting on the IRS guidance. But there has been definite activity and people that are definitely getting rolling out there across the country to use these. In the pieces of it, in OLIS, we provided, some writing, and there's a little diagram in there that I think is helpful just to kind of sort out the pieces. And there's kind of three pieces. And I'll start with the middle. The middle is the Qualified Opportunity Fund, okay? And it is a fund, it's specially set up as a corporation or partnership to take in money and invest in these opportunity zones. And a qualified opportunity fund has to hold, by and by, and there's a little bit of issues here with these IRS rules about how they transition and ramp up with respect to having 90% of their assets fully invested in an opportunity zone or opportunity zones. And these funds could take a variety of shapes. Some could be specially designed and set up for a single project, maybe kind of a real estate thing. That may be some of the first ones that we see really getting going here across the country. The idea was also that funds could set up, they could take subscribers from a variety of sources, and then they could use that money and to invest in a variety of businesses, more of a venture capital, helping entrepreneurs in these opportunity zones. So, and between those two models are any variety of permutations we may see arising in the next few months in a couple years. How they invest in the opportunity zones is, there are some parameters and boundaries there, but it can take basically three forms, as shown at the bottom of the chart there. At the far right is the more direct investment. They can actually purchase, the fund can run a business, trade or business, as it's called, business or trade or whatever, and actually own assets that, you know, of that property. And it has to be newly put into use in the zone or substantially improved. It has to be newly acquired from an unrelated party. There's some, you know, some basic outlines of things that I think the service will provide us with some more details about. The other two avenues are to buy equity in a business, okay? And that would be either partnership interests or stock, you know, originally issued by a company. You know, presumably a fairly small company that's generally actively engaged more or less exclusively in an opportunity zone or zones. Okay, so now we'll go back to the top of the chart and talk about how, where does the money flow into these funds that are doing the investment? And that comes from taxpayers or investors, however you want to look at it. And you know, they can invest any amount of money, but the primary thing that the federal tax code gives them a benefit for is newly realized gains. So a taxpayer sells something here since basically last year sometime at the earliest, and they turn that cash, the money they received in exchange for that asset, be it a stock, a piece of land, a building, a business, or inventory in the case of maybe more ordinary gains, so we'll see how the IRS guidance reads. But they take that money and within 180 days, they place it within an opportunity, a qualified opportunity fund, and that's what you have. And that's, and if they do that, then they don't have to pay the taxes on their federal tax return immediately with that tax year in which they sold the assets, as they normally would. They can defer those taxes on the gains until 2026, or their 2026 tax return at the very latest, or sooner if they actually sell or get out of their you know, subscription or ownership in the qualified opportunity fund. If they make that investment in the fund soon enough and hold it for 5 years, then the basis on those gains is increased by 10% of the total put in. So they save 10% of the taxes. Or if it's essentially the investment is made by next year and held for a total of 7 years, then that basis is increased by a total of 15%. If the money they put into the fund has lost value, the fund has not been terribly successful, then they don't have to pay the taxes on the original gains so much as the fair market value of that investment at the time. So that's the kind of the first set of incentives for investors. They have these old, these sort of historic gains that they receive a deferral and some reduction in the taxes due on them on a federal, and that would, as I think staff can explain, carry over to an Oregon taxpayer who, you know, is a resident of Oregon or has some sort of Oregon source capital gains. They sell a business in Oregon, maybe they're not a resident here. And those would be state capital gains that would be at least not paid until some years later. The other benefit, which wasn't receiving as much attention, but I think people are citing it as really very crucial for what may drive people to really put patient capital, as it is, in these opportunity zones. The idea being that if there's, you know, private backing for businesses or projects or other things in these zones, and it's not waiting for a quick return, that you know, that will help the economics of these areas, you know, among other things. I mean, it won't. I mean, it's probably going to take a concerted effort to really turn the economy around in these areas. But this is one tool, and I think a big part of that is if they put money in this fund and invest in these zones appropriately, then There are no capital gains on the future or capital gains taxes on the future capital gains earned in that zone if that investment is held for at least 10 years. And 10 years is a pretty good, that's a pretty long time to sink funds into something of this nature, I would say. But it doesn't just mean the 10 years. They could, if they could hold it for 20 or 30 years, that could be an awful lot of gains, even on a mildly successful investment that could build up. And come the 2030s or something, that would be essentially tax-free capital gains. So, you know, that is, so we'll see how that plays out as far as, you know, the inducement for people to really sort of sink into these funds and those funds to basically do business in these zones for a very long period of time. And again, that part of it, the sort of future gains and the tax-free nature after 10 years would be another issue for Oregon taxpayers that, you know, would otherwise owe taxes on those income taxes a decade or more from now. But that would include both Oregon residents as well as potentially new investors outside of Oregon who aren't otherwise involved in Oregon making investments that are somehow connected to Oregon. And one of the things, one of the issues I raised in the piece we provided for OLIS is whether that would be sourced based on the opportunity zone investment or where the opportunity fund is kind of located. And I think it'd probably be the fund because the taxpayer doesn't directly own anything in the zone per se. But we'll see. I mean, I think that's just one of my open questions at the state level as far as how the taxes would work. And I think with that, I'll just throw it open to questions. I'm sure you've got it all figured out by now, but I'd be happy to try if there's any more you'd like to explore.
I'm going to ask the first few questions, being the newest person here and knowing the least about this. And then I saw hands from Representative Bueller, Marsh. Okay. Could you please tell us about how many of these funds, are people going to call them QOFs, or are we going to use the whole term? Does it have an acronym yet?
Well, I've seen, Chair Nathanson, members of the Interim Committee, I have seen various acronyms used, QOF, O-Funds.
O-Funds.
We'll see. I mean, I think the funds will use their own kind of names. Uh-huh. They'll have business, Obsidian Fund is one that pops up in Oregon, Rockwood in Oregon. And there's several that are forming either preliminarily or they're just doing it very conservatively based on what the federal statutes are believed to be clear about. And it's already fairly active, and how people in the naming conventions are probably an interesting point.
Yeah. I just want to be sure that I'm using the correct hip lingo.
Well, I'm just quoting the statutes here. I'm not very hip, you know.
So you started to answer my first substantive question, which is how many do you anticipate there would be across the nation? Are we talking about hundreds or thousands of these things? Let me just get all of them out.
Okay.
So how many, where, will we have a few in Oregon and a bazillion in all the other states? Will it be roughly proportional to population or roughly proportional to where wealth is? Wealth is concentrated more in other states and not as much in Oregon. We know that from venture capital investment and so forth. And my other question is, given the potential for ownership, rather than just investment in a fund, but ownership, have you started to think through how active fund managers might be in making decisions of businesses located in our state and decisions that would affect whether they stay or leave to try to influence the activity of the business and the return on investment?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, first just to clarify whether the fund or the business would leave.
The business.
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. First of all, as far as the sheer quantity, that remains to be seen, but there's already probably dozens around the country at a, you know, at a point when there isn't a great deal known. The IRS has indicated there'll be self-certification, but the self-certification of the fund, you know, for all, which will lead into a lot of reporting and auditing types of situations, you know, still is probably about a month later than we were expecting. But I would put it at tens of thousands as far as total. I mean, some may be fairly small and they may get started and then they just peter out or they don't really attract enough investors or have enough money to put in. They could take a variety of forms. You could have funds that are basically Oregon-based as far as that's where they want to do business and that's what they're set up for, maybe through more of a nonprofit to some extent if there's more altruistic, philanthropic types of objectives involved or impact investment, if you will. But they might be registered in Delaware, okay? I mean, it's a limited partnership or something, an LP or something of that nature. Obviously, you would expect it more. You expect it to be somewhat, I think, concentrated as far as where they're managed or chartered or however you want to look at it, with financial centers. Okay, so there'll be a lot set up in New York by brokerages or those types of banks and stuff. But I do expect that any state, including Oregon, could have a great deal that are set up here, maybe as B corporations. I think the one in out of Rockwood, I've heard, is, or maybe it's B, or maybe it's set up by a B corporation registered in Oregon. You could have quite a variety in every state that is somewhat initiated by maybe local people of relatively high wealth that have, you know, significant gains that are worth, you know, doing, using this mechanism to delay the taxes on them. You could have entities that set up funds in various states, you know, Rockefeller or other types of foundations that set up things by regions or whatever, help to sponsor them. That's one of the kind of the initial things we're seeing is some of these foundations are looking for letters of interest from fund managers. The people that run the funds and how they use the, you know, the, how they earn their say and their chunk and their carried interest or their fees or whatever is a big question. Some might be pretty passive. They just look for something that fits the objectives of that fund. They park the money there and hope it does well. Others may be doing a lot of active monitoring, and there may be some churning in some of these funds. We'll see how that works. Of course, those funds will be tax-paying entities that will have to, you know, deal with those issues as they go along. But I think there's any variety of models there as far as how the fund management is set up and how active it is. I think on the venture capital side, I mean, if you're kind of helping to set aside or avoid some capital gains, that would get to one of the issues that has, I think, allegedly deterred some venture capitalists from Oregon, is that, you know, they don't want to pick up that, you know, that 9.999% tax rate on top of the federal one. So this may be an interesting avenue there, but boy, where the funds are quote located, that's somewhat something that I'm trying to struggle with myself. And then finally, the businesses, I think, will not be very footloose, at least not at least unless there are these companies that just, you know, are great and they do IPOs or something like that. I think the general model might be more, it might be high tech or other things, but these are probably not necessarily, you know, for many years, anything but fairly small companies that might be fairly domiciled in these zones, at least in terms of the businesses. Others are going to be very, and again, some of the criteria are very much around tangible assets, and those tangible assets being substantially all in one or more zones. So it's fairly, I think, fairly one of these things that might be fairly naturally fixed in a place.
Thank you very much. Representative Bueller.
Yeah, just a few questions. Thank you, Chair. When do you anticipate the administrative rules to be written by the IRS?
Representative Bueller, Chair Nathanson, members of the Interim Committee, when will they be released? My understanding at last, as I learned about a week ago, is that the service has passed the draft rules on to OMB. And under the Trump administration, there's this, even OMB is even overseeing IRS regulations. So I don't know how long that process will take, but hopefully by mid-October, there'll be officially proposed NPR, notice of proposed rulemaking in the federal bulletin or some sort of guidance issued through the TOA. So I basically am watching. I'm looking for forms that may come out, just to see. Taxpayers that want to put money into these gains have to make an election. And so there's a variety of issues, mainly technical ones, that we're looking forward to in these guidance, which may be in a few weeks, and then there may be more to come.
A couple of thoughts. Thanks, Chair Nathanson. And let me just ask you a few things to clarify timing. So do the gains have to be realized in 2018? Can it be in subsequent years?
Representative Bueller, Chair Nathanson, members of the interim committee, the law specifies that you basically for the previously realized gains, you cannot make an election after 2026, but you could realize those gains anytime from evidently, from what I understand, from sometime in 2017. I'll see how that works, but I mean that's some of what they've said is in online. That is the IRS, up through 2026. If you do it in 2026, obviously there isn't much time to defer them or gain any other incentive. But I would see the main push being by next year, if people are trying to get that full 15% reduction, ideally, is to, and they have gains. And I think the function of what gains, I mean, people realize gains because sometimes they need the money, and sometimes they have to get rid of something that they can't hold for any longer. But this would be presumably triggering a lot of people that have gains they've earned in something that was obviously successful at one time and is now kind of a dud. And so we'll see what people do basically this year, next, maybe into 2020 and so, as far as how much of the quote trillions that are supposedly out there might actually militate towards this.
Thank you, Chair. So we have 86 designated potential zones. The ones in the metro area are likely to get a lot of attention because we know where those are and there are obvious investment opportunities. Those of us who represent the more far-flung parts of the state are trying to figure out how do we get some of those trillions to our communities. Mm-hmm. I've heard discussion of trying to create an opportunity investment fund that would essentially package and market projects from our rural areas so that someone could come to that fund and immediately have their investment directed to, again, one of the opportunity sites that is not as obvious as the ones in the metro area. And that sounds like a pretty good idea to me, because we're going to have some sort of focus in order to direct money to places that are not immediately on people's list. Mm-hmm. So the question I have for you is, what can the state do to encourage that kind of packaging and essentially marketing of our more remote opportunity zones?
Representative Marsh, Chair Nathanson, members of the interim committee. Yeah, those are fair points. And in our selection process, we looked at the urban areas and figured there might be some fairly low-hanging fruit there for the investors and things. And some of it is not terribly exciting, assisted living or other types of investments. So there's definitely a lot of advantages that urban areas might further leverage through these opportunity zones, but there are a great deal in the rural areas, mm-hmm. a great deal that still could have been designated, but for the 86 limit. And I think you raise a good point. I haven't heard specifically about opportunity funds necessarily being organized for rural Oregon as far as Oregon. I've heard about the idea of funds being organized for rural parts of America and that sort of thing. So I wouldn't be a bit surprised. And I think at the department, we'd be very interested in that sort of thing, how you go about helping or pushing that along or moving. I mean, people talk even about states setting up opportunity funds or providing some sort of risk management tool or something like that to take the edge off of some of the downside for some of these potential investments. We're still just exploring that. One thing we have definitely explored in connection with, you know, some of the foundations that do work in Oregon, and by foundations, I mean, you know, philanthropic, is something that would be more of a clearinghouse mm-hmm. of fund or opportunities, projects, businesses down the road, and then would provide a way to sort of provide a means of plugging into opportunity funds that arise both nationally and more regionally, and that one of the focuses of that would be to, you know, give a special attention and to provide maybe more help through the EDDs or other state staffing to help the rural areas put together the information for that, and hope that a lot of the stuff in the urban areas can take care of itself more readily. So that's about all I have to offer, but I think the discussion of what the state can do is something that the legislature, as much as any agency, is certainly game to take up, I think, as you know, in the next short while.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I wanted to find out how much background research you all have done, because these opportunity zones used to be empowerment zones in the 90s, and there's research to show what its effects have been and what we could have learned from that and make sure that the way that we implement it, and I'm being direct in saying that research has shown that it has just not created wealth for supposedly what the goal is to build wealth amongst poor communities, has shown that actually it's just gone, wealth has just gone to those that already have wealth, and not build wealth amongst poor communities. So knowing what we've learned from empowerment zones, how can we actually achieve the goal of building wealth amongst poor communities?
Representative Fernandez, Chair Nathanson, members of the Interim Committee, that's a fair question. One of the reasons I'm involved, I deal with enterprise zones, so it's sort of a place, what they call a place-based strategy for sort of community and economic development. And again, wealth is a hard thing to measure, and I think there's a lot of trends in society that would be far more powerful than any federal policy would could possibly be that are at work here. But the Empowerment Zone program was actually very limited as far as the number of zones there were. There were none in Oregon or even the Northwest, as I recall. They were very selective, and actually, the research I've seen shows that the empowerment zones had some real strengths, because they really brought together a great deal of resources, both place-based as far as some tax breaks and considerable Social Security funds, as well as, and those monies could go into what people call people-based types of things. So that conjunction was very, I think, helpful for at least them improving sort of economic activity in these areas. How that filters into people's wealth is another great question. We tend to just look at the more immediate types of issues of just, you know, increasing employment, reducing poverty, and a lot of things like that. And those did, but there have been a few other efforts. I don't want to say there's been a lot of federal place-based policies. There really haven't been. But there were, with the empowerment zones came enterprise communities, and we had two in Oregon. There's been some other things over the years. New market tax credits are kind of similarly focused geographically, but otherwise operate very differently, and that probably has not been as, I mean, it's done. They've done some great things with revitalizing certain areas, but not so much necessarily with, I think, improving people's lives, as you were referring. So I think the emphasis in what you're talking about and to learn from those lessons is sort of a role. We'll see what the service says about, you know, putting in some guardrails or whatever. But again, they're tax collectors. They're not, and so with the way this came out, we're not looking for a big much from the federal. But if you can combine this and use it with other resources, you know, be it the U.S. Department of Agriculture, HUD, other types of programs, low-income housing tax credits at the federal level, state and local programs and efforts that really try to focus on some of the people in these areas, then I think you're on the way to methods that will make both the opportunity zones more successful and their impact more successful. But that's just broad policy observations. I have nothing more specific to offer.
Can I follow? Thank you, Chair Nathanson. And we've already identified the census tracts in this state that qualify for the opportunity zones, correct?
Representative Hernandez, Chair Nathanson, members of the interim committee, yes. The deadline was very quick. We weren't given a great deal. None of the states were. We had 25% of essentially, basically 10% of our tracts could be designated. And that's true across the country. There's 8,700, more or less, around the country. And again, they tend, I think this is true in Oregon, they tend to even be a little more hardship-based than even the general group that you could choose from.
Right.
But we did look to make sure these were areas that, you know, could entertain business locations and that sort of thing, and looked at a variety of issues.
Quick follow-up. I saw that our Portland downtown is designated as an opportunity zone, and I was curious as to why that is. I mean, do we really need to build, to give tax incentives to build more buildings in downtown Oregon, I mean, downtown Portland, mm-hmm. and what the economic benefit is for, you know, I believe that the reason why it was designated an opportunity zone is because there's a lot of homeless population and a lot of resources for homeless populations in downtown, and therefore that's in the data and therefore designated low-income census tract. But it's hard for, you know, folks in low-income communities to say, yeah, there should be tax incentives in downtown for buildings.
Excellent question, Representative Hernandez, members of the committee, interim committee, Chair Nathanson. This was the sort of thing we batted about and looked at various factors and looked to try to cluster some of these. You know, I mean, one little opportunity zone in the middle of, you know, out by itself might not do that much. So part of the reason you ended up with a few downtown together is to try to cluster, as it was called. And there's another cluster in the Rockwood area of East Portland, Gresham, kind of ties into Rosewood, and some other places. But it's hard, you know, with 86, you know, you got to kind of spread the peanut butter, but you don't want to spread it too thin. So, and one of the places where a glob was left was downtown Portland. And I think the idea was that there is some low-hanging fruit there. Obviously, there is the populations there that make it eligible. And actually, there are a lot of residents there, homeless or not, that, you know, could use probably more good. But it is a place where if this program is sort of, you know, it's not as grand and big, we could at least be sure that Oregon could get some of this investment. So, you know, I mean, we can talk about, you know, trillions of dollars, but it, you know, it may be a fairly modest program in terms of how much actually goes on. And so we wanted to have some places in the state that were safe bets to make sure that at least we got some of what happened. And I think there is generally a feeling that that could be a very attractive place for some major investments that could benefit the whole state, as well as those areas in particular.
Just one last comment I would add. Thank you, Chair. Mm-hmm. I think what my biggest concern is, if we're not being intentional, and I know that you have certain limitations on what you can and can't do, and that you're going to focus within the boundary that you're given, but us as elected officials and those of us who have control over what kind of programs we could develop, if we're not being intentional of how to prevent gentrification from happening after these incentives are done, from making sure that the wealth that is built from the tax incentives somehow trickle down to the poor, and build wealth amongst poor communities, I'm not sure that without that intentionality, without actually having these programs connected and these goals connected to these opportunity zones, that we're going to see generational poverty really change. That's just a comment more so than a question.
Thank you. Representative Finley.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I have a couple of two-part questions. Is this income going to be taxable in Oregon, or is it Oregon going to tax exempt that income along with the federal government?
Representative Finley, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I mean, that's sort of the nuts and bolts that we're here to, I think, emphasize, is that this does carry over to state taxpayers to the extent you have Oregon gains, and I talked about that both in terms of the original amounts that might go into these funds. As at present, people, they would claim, they would elect or exclude those gains from their, whatever, 10-4, not 10-4, their Schedule Ds, and it would end up being carried over to their state tax returns, generally personal, but also some corporate, potentially. And they would be, you know, deferred. I mean, some of it would be collected, well, 85% or more of it potentially would be collected, you know, within several years at the latest, but it would be affected. And then these future gains that might be earned, depending upon whether it's sourced based on the fund or the zone or whatever, would also carry over through the tax code in Oregon because we're so thoroughly connected.
Have those rules been written in Oregon yet?
Representative Finley, Chair Nathanson, members of the interim committee, my understanding is that Oregon doesn't have to do anything. There may be some issues that arise. This sourcing issue may be something that at least the Department of Revenue needs to look at to clarify. I don't know if it would even rise to the level of an administrative rulemaking, but I'm not sure what the state necessarily needs to do at this point, except just ride the wave, too.
I guess my whole goal is I just want to make sure that when the Federal Register comes out and the rules become final, that we are in Oregon are ready to embrace the program and move it forward and accept the funds. There's a lot of these zones that were established that are looking for some capital, form of capital. Mm-hmm. And I would hate to say that, well, we would now have to write the rules or Department of Revenue is going to administer parts of it. I want to make sure that we're ready, and if there's anything that we can do to assist that, I'd like to see that we're there.
Representative Finley, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I think we're ready on the tax side. Again, I think, as the chair pointed out, Oregon is not a huge source. It's not the center of all wealth in the country. So some of this is would come from outside the area too, in various ways, and we'll see how that would be affected as far as these future gains. But if somebody has earned some gains outside of Oregon and they want to invest it here, our tax code doesn't even matter at all, except down the road they may take comfort from not having to pay a state tax on that after 10 years on those gains. So
I guess I would argue with you, there was an additional $50 million in revenue from estate taxes realized this last quarter. I think we do have revenue, and I think we do have wealth, and if we could figure out how to hide some of that or protect it, I think we should be ready to do that.
Well, yeah, I think our main role in terms of getting the most out of this is on, you know, what we can do to help these areas, you know, identify what they have and find places to, you know, where, because people are going to, you know, they're not going to just go for the tax savings. They want to at least have a reasonable return depending upon their objectives as far as what they're doing in these zones. And so finding, you know, so those opportunities is an important deal. So I'm not too worried about our tax side of things at this point.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good seeing you, Art.
No, likewise.
Really quick, committee, I want you to know this gentleman does really, really good work for the state of Oregon in Business Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to work with you.
Me too.
I want to follow up on Rep. Hernandez and Rep. Finley's questions. With Oregon's tight connection to federal income tax laws, there's going to be an opportunity cost. either there's going to be greater investment in 86 potential areas, but there's also going to be the loss of revenue to the state of Oregon. Has the executive branch, has the state of Oregon taken a position on which is more important to them, investment in these opportunity zones or loss of potential income to the state of Oregon?
Vice Chair Smith, Chair Nathanson, members of the interim committee, no. The state has not taken an official position on that. The governor's office was enthusiastic about, you know, participating, like every state has, in terms of having these nominations, again, many of which would attract investment that, you know, would have no effect on Oregon revenues in the immediate term. And in the long run stuff, unfortunately, is long run, and we tend not to necessarily have even a clue about it. How much would be affected from Oregon taxpayers as far as what they might do? You know, the thing is, it's hard to be clear even how significant that would be. I'm not saying it's insignificant. I think it could be quite amount of money. But a lot of it would be ultimately collected. It just might be a few years later. So administratively, it wasn't seen as being, you know, to represent Finley's point, administratively, it was seen as not being an issue. So to speak, but that, the revenue, I think, is an important thing for the legislature to look at. Getting a handle on it, I mean, I don't think there's any way to know for many years what we're talking about.
Just a quick follow-up. Oh, boy. I'm going to follow up with Representative Marsh's question. With 86 tracks around the state, some areas have a more sophisticated professional team that can drive opportunity zones.
Yes.
Other areas do not.
Mm-hmm.
Who's driving this conversation in the more rural parts of the state? Are we relying on CPAs? Are we relying on economic development organizations? Who's getting the word out that these zones exist, and who's helping folks to create these? Who's driving the process?
Vice Chair Smith, Chair Nathanson, members of the interim committee, that's a great question. And, you know, even our agency, we're trying to, you know, now that, you know, the dust has settled on the nominations, and it has settled, and we're trying to get more information out there as far as, you know, the 86 that are, they are what they are, and get the news out and, you know, talk about this more. Again, you know, it's, you know, I think we'll see the IRS guidance is kind of at least a great excuse to sort of, you know, just sort of think about it for now, and hopefully we'll get more activity. Again, this is a lot of stuff between taxpayers and their accountants and their tax advisors, and I talk to people on a regular basis and say, I can't be your tax advisor. But I think you're right. I mean, a lot of this, you know, for local areas to get the most out of it, rural or otherwise. And I think in your case, some of the places you work with and other parts of rural Oregon are very well staffed, and people make a huge difference in the community development, economic development sphere. But that's one of our challenges, and we're looking at maybe some sort of mechanism to kind of profile across the state equally, but with the understanding that different levels of support need to be done for different areas, that, you know, hopefully the metro areas can just plug into this and put together the things that are really impactful, that, you know, won't just take care of themselves between investors and their advisors, and then look at the rural areas and see what can be done. And the other element is twinning, as people like to say, which is where you twin with the opportunity zone, other types of things. And our Oregon Enterprise Zones are natural. There's hardly anything that needs to be done there as far as a joint incentive for certain types of business opportunities. But as far as infrastructure, other things that might specifically help some of these cracked or some of these tracks and the things that could go on in them is another element of coordination that I think needs to be looked at. And I'm afraid we don't at the agency have figured out what all that we can do. We're still open-minded to that, and are looking into that as well, and very happy to take your suggestions.
Thank you. And again, you do a great job for the state.
Okay.
Representative Noes.
I think my question's already been asked.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Fish, for coming and explaining all this to us.
If you say so.
Yeah. To Representative Smith's question about loss of revenue to Oregon, when these investment funds are invested and they're implemented in a zone, will that not create, we hope, more jobs, which then would create new income, which then could offset revenue loss to the capital gains side, but be realized on the income side?
Well, Representative Reschke, Chair Nathanson, members of the Interim Committee, naturally, I mean, that is one of our, I mean, again, from this committee's perspective and the fine work that staff does, and I mean, we could deal with trying to put a thought exercise on sort of the kind of the static first dimension loss of revenue or affected revenue, be it how much you could rely on it for anything, I think is you know, I think, you know, with all due respect, is hard to say. Generally, you know, we would argue that a lot of the stuff we do has a return, and that would be part of the return to the state would be through the income taxes that might be generated by increased economic activity in these areas. So I think that's very real, and I think it's very well worth keeping in mind, but I can't necessarily put a dollar figure on it any easier than I could much less so perhaps than even the gains that might be more immediately affected.
Thank you, and a quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so we have 50 states doing this exercise, right?
And six territories.
And six territories. Okay, thank you. That gets us to 56 using higher math. So is anybody watching the other 55 areas to see if anybody's in the lead on this project? So maybe Delaware's got a great idea and they're implementing it differently than the rest of the states and territories. I'm just wondering if we're watching others as we're all kind of inching into this brave new world, if there's a better way to do this and a worse way to do it.
Representative Reschke, Chair Nathanson, members of the Interim Committee, appreciate the time you've given me here. I mean, we're looking. I mean, there's crowdfunding happening in Washington, D.C., and some interesting real estate things happening in Arizona. A lot of the sort of imitating and learning will, of course, occur in the private sector. And I think if states and funds and other things that are more impact-oriented or public benefit-oriented arise, that hopefully, you know, we can learn from each other. We're plugged in with organizations, the Council for Development Finance agencies and others that have been engaged in D.C. with rulemaking and education. So, you know, it's just a question of capacity. I mean, I have other roles to do, and, you know, so we haven't assigned a huge amount of staff to this, to say the very least. But I think Oregon has a lot of players both locally and around the state that are getting more engaged in this and will hopefully be able to, you know, learn from their counterparts in other states, and it's not necessarily a state function.
Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the lineup of members asking questions.
Great. One more question.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. There's always that one guy. Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Yes. So is there one point of contact within Business Oregon who is responsible for leading this project?
Representative Buehler, Chair Nathanson, members of the Interim Committee, I'm the contact. I'm happy to talk with people and lead the charge, but as far as a really organized structure and so forth, as far as how we're approaching this, no, we're still working on that at the moment.
Thank you for being with us today.
You bet.
Really appreciated all of the questions and responses. More to come on that one, huh?
Thank you for your interest.
We're now moving on to the second item on the agenda, Department of Revenue.
Go to your MBA and learn how to do it. I don't want to be rich.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Nia Ray. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Revenue. I have with me Ken Ross, who is the interim legislative administrator for the department. Ken is new to the role, but not to the department. Ken presented to this committee earlier this year when he was the section manager for the personal income tax division. Ken is a former legislative coordinator for the department, roles currently occupied by Deanna Mack and Mark Garst. In this role, he will manage our legislative efforts to ensure that they are internally and externally aligned and aligned across committee. Deanna and Mark are still on staff and will be working very closely with the committee on behalf of the department. Our goal today is first to honor the goal of brevity espoused by the chair, and second, to leave the committee with a high-level overview of our administrative approach to federal tax reform. LRO has kept you very well abreast of revenue impacts of tax reform. We'd like to provide insight into what these changes mean to our daily operations. Oregon was one of the first states to pass legislation in response to the changes at the federal level. Earlier this year, the legislature passed Senate Bill 1529, which repealed our tax haven law, and Senate Bill 1528, which disconnected from the federal pass-through entity deduction but expanded the list of claimants eligible for the state pass-through entity reduced income tax rate. Today's presentation will focus more on the personal income tax side of the tax code, discuss how the changes will impact our forms and processes, and our outreach related to those changes. Before I turn it over to Ken, I offer the committee a heartfelt apology. I have a 9:30 legislative commitment that I have to meet, but you will certainly be in good hands with Ken. With that, Ken, you got it.
Your turn.
Thank you, Nia. Again, my name is Ken Ross. I'm the legislative administrator for the Department of Revenue, and I have a handful of slides today to talk about federal tax reform, as we're calling it, which is interchangeable with the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. A couple slides on just how it affected us administratively, and then, like, say, a few on a specific issue around withholding and the federal W-4 form. Okay. Not getting into detail here. As Chris alluded to earlier, they've been in here a couple of times. We'll continue their foray into the federal tax reform later today. Just suffice it to say that it's been big. There's a mix of changes, both the individual and on the business side, that affected how we do business. Earlier in the year, when this was unfolding, we got together and looked at how we thought this was going to affect us. We actually put together a budget ask, thinking that if we didn't get guidance and the changes from the IRS in a timely fashion, if they came late in the year, we might need outside help to get us ready, would compress our window to get ready for the next tax season. It turns out we didn't need that. The IRS surprised everybody in the tax world and came out with updated forms in late June. So it allowed us to start on our work in a timely fashion, kept us on the same track that we typically are on this time of year. Probably the biggest administrative change, as Nia said, is on the personal income tax side and the changes they made to their forms. The IRS completely redesigned the federal 1040. Actually, they changed the 1040 series. They eliminated the 1040 EZ and the 1040A and created a postcard size 1040. Actually, it's half a page. It's on both sides. It's a two-sided postcard. To do that, they took and removed a number of lines, put them on schedules. So they created six schedules, and depending on your tax situation, you could use none or up to all six of the schedules to complete your return. And I believe the IRS has estimated about 30% of the taxpayers will be able to file the 1040 just using the form itself without any of the schedules. So getting all the information from the IRS early, like I said, kept us on track. And the good news here is we are on schedule for the next tax season. We were able to start our work and on our forms. We created a new Schedule A. This is the form that allows taxpayers to claim itemized deductions. At the federal level, all the changes, it's kind of, in effect, move people from taking itemized deductions and move them to a standard deduction as they significantly increase the standard deduction. I think LRO was in here and said that Oregon taxpayers that itemize for federal purposes, about 40% of them, after the changes, so next year that will drop to about 15%. For Oregon, LRO, I'd like to quote them, they said that about half of Oregon taxpayers itemize deductions, about 47%, and these federal changes won't affect that. We'll still have about half of our taxpayers itemizing for next year. So we thought it was imperative that we create our own form because more Oregon taxpayers will be itemizing for Oregon than they will for federal. And we will ask folks to attach the schedule to their return, whether they itemize for federal or not. Mm. Of course, we had a number of forms on both on the personal income tax and the corporate side that we needed to update for the new changes. And then we also had business rules that we use for processing tax returns that we needed to be updated. And an example of a business rule, Oregon law allows taxpayers to subtract their federal tax liability from income, and by law it's limited. So this past year the limit was $6,550, in case you wanted the exact amount. We hard code that. We build that dollar limit into our system, so the system won't allow anyone to claim more than what's allowed by law. So that's just an example of a business rule. Like I said, we were able to get all this done, all our form changes done by, and our business rules updated by September 1. We pass those all over to the programming side, to our IT folks, and they are busily programming our systems. We have systems, two sides of our systems. We have the data capture side and then, of course, the processing side. On the data capture, we have a number of systems. For personal income tax, we have a manual where we hand key paper returns, so those filers that file on paper. Unfortunately, that's only about 5% of our filers anymore, but we have a system that where we can key those. We have a 2D system, which is if you use software to prepare your return and you print it out, it will print a barcode at the top of it, much like the barcode that's on the can of beans at the grocery store. So we can just scan that. All the information is contained in the barcode, and it you don't have to key it. And then, of course, we have an e-file system. For corporation, we have the e-file system, and new this year, we just rolled it out last month, is a new scanning system that can optically read forms. So for the corporate forms next year, we're going to be scanning and gathering the data through just reading the forms. The machines can do that. With all the changes, we know that we're going to have extensive testing. Because we rely on federal so much, we basically map the federal return, and it changed so much, we're really just starting over. So we'll shift some resources once everything's programmed to do the testing, and use folks that we had used when we rolled out our GenTax system. And then that's the final piece of it, is our, on the processing side, the data capture sends all the information to our new processing system, and that's GenTax. All this was done with a goal of being ready for the new tax season. We'd like to be done about a week before the IRS opens up their personal income tax, which is usually about mid-January. So, like I said, we're on track for that. Okay, I'd like to get a little bit into a specific issue that we're seeing that has arisen with all the federal tax changes, and that has to do with withholding and the federal W-4. And if you were here or caught the economic forecast at the end of last month, our economists alluded to this situation that has them a little bit nervous, because this is all dependent on taxpayer behavior. Basically, in a nutshell, the federal tax changes have reduced tax for a large number of Oregon taxpayers. And I believe that LRO estimated that about 70% of Oregon taxpayers will pay less federal tax come this next year. And so in preparation for that, because the federal government as well as Oregon has a tax system that is pay-as-you-go, pay-as-you-earn, basically, which means you pay the tax as you earn the income. So for wage earners, that means withholding. If you're a business owner, that means you make quarterly estimated payments. But since the large percentage of our taxpayers are wage earners, this has an effect on them and us. The IRS, knowing that their rates were reduced, all the changes, they went in and they updated their withholding tables at the beginning of the year. That went into effect in February. They also changed their Form W-4, which is the mechanism that employers use to calculate withholding. So the W-4, if you recall, is a form that the employee completes and submits to their employer, and it gets you to a place, it gets you to a filing status and number of allowances. So you may be single in one or married in four, and the employer takes that information and goes and calculates their withholding. So they updated their W-4, and the way they address the lower tax for most people is that they created more allowances. So where you were single in one, you might be single in three, or married and you were married in four. This year you could be married in 10, is how they addressed it. And then they are looking, originally for 2019, they were going to change it again. They had come out with a revised W-4 form where they went totally away from allowances. And they got a lot of pushback from the payroll and the tax professional communities, so they've actually pulled back. We learned last week that they are pulling back on that idea at least for one more year. They'll revise 19, but it'll be similar to 18, and then they'll come back in 20 with a new version of the W-4. And all they said is that it will have important changes, whatever that means. So we're watching that. So why that's important to Oregon is because for years, Oregon has matched the federal W-4 process. It's in our statute. We have the same allowance-based withholding process that they have at the federal level. We've even gone so far as to use the federal form. We don't have a separate W-4 for Oregon. We've asked individuals to use the federal W-4 for years. Our law says if you complete a W-4 and you don't do a separate one for Oregon, then your allowances are the same as what you claim for federal for Oregon purposes. You've always been able to complete a second one, a federal form, and write for Oregon only at the top. So that's been our process for a number of years. And behind the scenes, much like at the federal level, the Department of Revenue has provided formulas and withholding tables for the employer to use to take the filing status and the allowances and come up with the withholding. And, of course, we use the same factors, pretty much the same factors as they do at the IRS. Marital status, allowances, how often you get paid, and then something that's unique for Oregon as we factor in the federal tax subtraction. All right, so let me get into a couple of issues that we're seeing that have come up with all these changes and how that's affected Oregon. The big issue is that the potential for folks to be underwithheld, who have not paid in enough withholding during the year, is the number one issue, and that could come up in a number of ways. If they filed they got a new job, so they filed a W-4 for federal purposes, and they did not complete a second one and for Oregon only.
Oh boy!
So if they filed a W-4, claimed 8 allowances for federal purposes under the old system, 4 would have worked, and 4 is what they need for Oregon. If they didn't do a separate one, it could cause them to be under withheld for this tax year.
For the state of Oregon.
Under what's held for the state of Oregon.
For the state of Oregon, yes. Yes, thank you.
Since there's been a brief interruption, you said if they didn't fill out a separate one for Oregon, what's their signal that they should? Who's telling them to fill out the second one?
Chair Nathanson, that's a good question. Actually, on my next slide, we talked a little bit about the outreach that we've done. The IRS has done pretty extensive outreach this year to remind people to double check their withholding, their W-4. It's not mandatory. It's totally dependent on taxpayer behavior. We have done some outreach to individuals and through press releases. We've done.
Oh, I don't know any of my neighbors who look at your news releases. Sorry.
90%. Chair Nathanson, fair enough.
Okay. Well, I mean, we don't look at all of them.
Right. And Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, it's a challenge. It is a challenge. It's not intuitive. And I don't know, in the course of your employment, I don't know how often you've even contemplated your W-4 unless you were changing jobs. So we recognize that as a challenge within the department. There are limitations, unfortunately, to the immediate access we have. So the most immediate access we have is through the employer, ensuring that they're aware and they're aware of our initiatives. And in other cases, for example, we've inserted reminders in payroll stubs or payroll leaflets. So we are making every communication effort that we can, but we understand that it's a high bar. And so really with consistency, we're hoping we can reach the population that needs the information.
I'm going to allow one more question on this topic, then we probably need to move on and schedule some follow-up on this one part of the...
Madam Chair, so the ramifications of this is starting to overwhelm me a little bit. So I have two teenagers who have changed jobs quite regularly in the last year and a half, and they get ample help filling out their sort of tax situation because they don't either remember to do it or inquire about it or the withholding was done wrong. I mean, just, you know, normal stuff that young adults are sort of struggling with. I don't remember them inquiring about whether they needed to fill out a W-4 for Oregon. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just not even a thing I recall.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I think federal tax reform is illuminating issues we may not have contemplated otherwise, and we're learning about, you know, behaviors of taxpayers and needs of taxpayers that we just haven't contemplated before. So with that, I think that's an excellent observation, and it's those types of observations that are fueling our outreach efforts and understanding who we really need to target in these efforts.
I mean, Madam Chair, my children don't even get a pay stub. It's like their employers, they do it all online now. You know, like when we have to help them figure out why they didn't get paid, or they have to have a code, they have to have email, they have to remember it. I mean, just, you know.
Yeah. Well, we're going to ask about your Twitter account later. Seriously. Please continue.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. So... there's another situation that could cause them to be under withheld, and I'm a little hesitant to get into that, but I will. just in the tax changes themselves, at the federal level, where they essentially have moved people from itemizing to taking the standard deduction, and the standard deduction for federal purposes nearly doubled. And for example, we have one of the deductions that went away was employee business expenses. So if you worked for an employer, you traveled, and you did not get reimbursed for it, you could claim that expense on your tax return as an itemized deduction. Well, that was eliminated for 2018. So at the federal level, the standard deduction may have covered it, but for Oregon, since we don't have a standard deduction that's high, it basically, for Oregon purposes, they just lose that deduction. And if all else was the same, their Oregon tax would be higher. So there's a couple. Those are the couple situations with that folks could be under withheld. for 2019, and this is to Representative Nose's point, we realize that we have to have a separate process for Oregon. We have created an Oregon W-4 and make it clear that you have to do something different for Oregon. Because for now, we have to continue our process. So it still be allowance-based, but you have to do something different for Oregon because claiming 10 for federal won't work for Oregon.
Aren't you glad you're not in Ways and Means anymore?
So, last slide.
Numbers
here.
Used to mean something over on Ways and Means.
You don't speak for yourself.
So we talked a little bit about the outreach that we've done. We have revised. We do have a worksheet that helps folks walk through the W-4. We've had that for a number of years. We've updated that to take into account the federal changes. We are building an online calculator. This is will look have a, much the same look and feel as the online calculator that the IRS has that does basically the same thing as the worksheet. It walks you through your situation. It tries to factor in not just those wages, but your entire situation. If you have a second job, you have a spouse that works for wages, you have investment income, you have itemized deductions, you have tax credits. It tries to walk you through all that to get you to a good place for your withholding. We are creating a new W-4 for Oregon. Both the calculator and the form, we will have our goal is to have them out there by December 1 so that if folks need to make changes for 2019, they'll have it at the beginning of the year. And then we are researching, we're analyzing what other processes are out there. We're looking at other states. A lot of states have a separate process from the IRS, and we're looking to see if there's something that would be a better fit for us that might make it simpler, might make for not just for us to administer, but for the employee and the employer. And with that, I'll take questions.
Oh, how brave of you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming and explaining this. So if the legislature had not taken the action it did with Senate Bill 1528, and we remained connected to the federal tax code the way we were by default, this wouldn't be happening, correct, where we'd have to create a separate W-4 form?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, yeah, I think that's partially true for the itemized deductions, but not
entirely. Okay.
Right.
All right. And I'll just make a quick comment that in my view, looking at a sales tax instead of an income tax seems more and more friendly to Oregonians than ever before. We just keep getting more and more complicated, and even our experts don't know what's coming up. So this is a comment.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. More of a comment than anything else. Colleagues, the Department of Revenue is a general fund-based agency, and so the activities that are before us are going to cost us dollars, and I think we all need to be aware of that and make sure we're supportive of the agency when this budget request comes, because the request is soon coming, I'm assuming you're talking with folks, but these are dollars that otherwise would be going into education or public safety or Department of Human Services, we're now going to be having to spend on this activity. It's no critique, it's just an observation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two questions. Number one, how are other states dealing with this?
That's
have you
question.
Done any of any kind of check-in on, because I'm assuming that particularly that I hadn't realized the odd tweaking that they were doing on the federal level to kind of account for the withholding, and so I wondered how other states were doing that compared to how we are.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith Warner, as I said, most from what our initial research, we've seen that most states have their own process. It's different from the federal government, so the changes wouldn't affect them like it does us. For example, we've looked at Arizona, and Arizona's W-4 has six check boxes on it. It says, tell us what percentage of tax you would like to have withheld. So it doesn't matter what the law changes were. They're just having a percentage withheld. So,
interesting. Thank you. And can I ask my second easy one? So I was very struck by about the 1040, and I know this is the feds and not you guys, the estimate that about 30% of filers would just do the 1040. Do you know how many used to use the 1040 EZ? I mean, maybe just because for many, many years of my tax paying, that's all I ever used. So I would have assumed that the 1040 EZ was perhaps a higher percentage than that, or?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith-Warner, I don't know that figure. We could get that for you.
Okay.
How is it working with the automated software that people use for filing? Do you have discussions with those private sector products on how have they already started changing everything so that it's going to be accurate when it gets to you?
Chair Nathanson, absolutely. We start working with software vendors early in the year so that they can have their systems ready to go. It's really important because between the 2D returns and the e-file returns, about 95% of the returns are software generated anymore.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, a third goal of this presentation is to do as Vice Chair Smith suggested, to socialize the committee around the administrative needs of the agency. This year, within the past year and a half, we implemented six new tax programs, which is a bit of a difference from prior years. Prior years, you'd have maybe one per biennium, maybe not even that. But as we have, robust discussions around tax reform and where we're headed, and as these smaller tax programs are legislated, it will have an impact on the departmental footprint. And it's important that you understand what's required to stand up a new tax program, that it isn't necessarily a one template fits all operation, that there are startup costs around it, and there are administrative needs. Most of those needs will be presented to our ways and means side, our budget side, but at the same time, with respect to prioritization of programming and programs and departmental needs, it may be instructive for you as you contemplate your tax positions.
Good. Thank you. Well, we're a bit ahead of schedule if there are no additional questions for this panel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next item is tax credit auctions. Are both agencies coming up together?
Film and video.
Great. Everybody.
I guess I'll go first.
Chair Nathanson, member of the committee. My name is Tim.